Richard, we could start, if you don't mind, by essentially telling your origin story. How did...
Oh, well, let's see. I grew up in California and went to Stanford University, studied mathematics, and took a few computer courses, which there weren't many in those days, and got into the computer doing software, doing programming. So for 30 years, I was in the software industry, and I was lucky working really at all the leading edge companies, you know. Like I was at Xerox Research Center when they were developing the concepts of the personal computer. And then I moved over to Apple and was there for, I don't know, maybe about 8 years, two different times.
So and you, you were like at the Xerox Park?
Yeah, I was, which awesome. Is a fairly prestigious place. But I was there just as on a contract helping out a fellow named Larry Tesler, who was one of the stars there. I mean, I wasn't a star myself at all, really, but I was there in the, you know, in the chats and the luncheon conversations and watching the technologies develop. So I was lucky to have those kind of experiences.
Yeah.
Which teaches you a lot about organizations and how corporations work and how teams work and all that kind of stuff. And then I had in between stints at Apple, I had my started my own company doing electronic mail software. And actually, it was ahead of its time. I should be a millionaire, but somebody made a lot of money from the product, but I didn't have the business. I didn't know how to run a business. So. Anyway, so I was in the industry for 30 years and finally decided that I just wanted to do more with my life, you know, do something real for the involving the world rather than just working for money, you know?
Yes.
So I took what retirement funds I had, one of those retirement account things, and moved to Ireland.
Nice.
I wanted to get away from everything because when you're in your environment, there's all kinds of distractions, things going on, blah, 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 you're busy all the time. So I wanted to clear the decks where I didn't know anybody and I could just write and sort of research. My basic questions were, you know, how does the world work and how can we change it?
This is like the mid-90s?
Yeah, it was about 94 I moved to Ireland.
Okay. And do you have a family?
Yeah, I've got two kids back in California and three grandkids and brother and sister and mother living in Hawaii.
Oh, nice, nice.
So when I do go back, I go to nice places and have a good time. You know, great places. It's just that culturally, I came to Ireland to get away from everything so I could write. But in fact, I found that I absolutely love the society here and the culture.
Has that stayed consistent? I mean, as far as I understand, there's been some substantial economic changes in two directions there since you've been there.
Yeah, I was here when I first moved here. You could like buy a house for like £27,000 or something.
Yeah,
and now, you know, it's hundreds of thousands. So there was a big housing bubble, and it was all just part of the programmed bubble collapse scenario, and Ireland got caught in it rather heavily.
Yeah.
But all of that is kind of irrelevant to just what it's like to live in a town. See, I found out I'm a townie, you know, living in a town, walking everywhere, no need for a car. And, you know, you walk down the street and you always see people, you know, and stop and talk. It's the kind of thing that just never happened in the States.
For sure.
Just also, you know, it's all, you know, you see a pedestrian in the city. Wow, look, there's somebody walking. I wonder what's wrong with them. Maybe their car broke down, you know. Here there's traffic of baby buggies and, you know, different kind of traffic. I really enjoy that.
Are you in a large town?
Well, it's large. It has everything you need. It's not a village.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot bigger towns in Ireland, but it's just perfect size, you know, not too big, not too small, just right.
Okay. And are you involved in the pub life?
Well, there's a traditional music group I play with sometimes, playing harmonica. And then there's people I play. We have pool contests and snooker contests and poker on Tuesday nights.
Sounds like you're in it.
And it usually happens in pubs. It's just a natural place to gather. So, I think my theory about pubs is that with so much poverty for so many years and everything, people didn't have big houses or liquor cabinets and entertaining people in the way you would in America. It just wasn't economically feasible, you know?
Yeah.
So the pub became kind of everybody's parlor.
Yeah, there's no age restrictions in a pub?
Well, it depends on the pub. I mean, legally there probably are, but I've seen pubs where there'd be kids there, especially the smaller, where there's not some chance they're trying to drink or something, you know, depending on the pub and the,
okay.
You know. But you don't see a lot of kids in pubs once it gets dark. It'd be unusual. Like maybe somebody bringing a dog in, you know, it might happen, but it's kind of unusual.
So I thought that there was a big economic crash going on in Ireland. That's not the case.
Well, there's a crash all over Europe and in Ireland and in the United States. But it's funny how you don't really see it. There's still traffic. You know, there's still people going to work. There's still shops. But it's, you know, the unemployment going way up, the number of people on welfare going way up, cuts in the budget every year, and all the assets being sold off, you know, the forests and the water rights and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So in some sense it shows up as little as possible in the street because there isn't particularly, you know, they particularly want people to be aware of it enough to, I don't know, have a lot of unrest about it.
Yeah, to be frightened.
Yeah, it's just sort of everything's being pulled out from under us, and then pretty soon we'll find out there's nothing left.
Yeah. And so what brought you to write the Matrix piece?
Well, it was just, like I said, I was trying to figure out how does the world really work. And so as I was, you know, that actually I don't think is a very difficult problem. it's pretty well documented. I mean, it's basically a small number of people making the decisions that run the world. And, you know, hierarchy itself is the problem. I mean, we've basically 6,000 years of civilization has been 6,000 years of the evolution of hierarchy. And so inevitably, you're eventually going to get to a one world tyranny. I mean, you know, the great generals of history, you know, Alexander the Great or Genghis Khan or Caesar and, you know, or Hitler. I mean, everybody was trying to conquer the world. And so now, finally, we've got a group that is succeeding.
Yes.
So since about 98, I guess, I've really been concerned more with how do we change things.
Yeah.
Although, one cannot help but continue to develop one's understanding of what's going on in the world and fine-tuning and, you know, homing in on it. But in terms of specific plans and stuff, always the real problem is how do we change things? How do we overcome hierarchy?
Yeah, but you do think it's important that people have some idea of how they're being exploited or abused.
I think I've been thinking about that a lot. It's really, it's almost like there's a need to know spectrum. Not need to know in the sense of withholding information, but need to know in the sense of what is it that motivates people. And I think the majority of people are as dissatisfied as they need to be. and getting everybody to understand about chemtrails and HAARP and you know, central banker conspiracies. I don't think, first of all, a lot of people just aren't going to want to go there with those kind of ideas, for psychological reasons and conditioning reasons and all kinds of stuff. And so there's no use trying to fight that battle. What most people, you might say the silent majority, what they need is they need to have alternatives presented. There needs to be, like in something like co-ops and things like that, there needs to be things offered to them that offer significant economic advantages. That's the only way they're going to get involved. If they can see advantage in joining in the movement, so to speak, then they will. Otherwise, they won't. Because the number of people, the people who are willing to put effort into saving the world, those are activists. And
yes.
We see them, and there's a certain number of them, and they show up at demonstrations, et cetera, et cetera. And that number is not going to grow. And so what the activists need to be working on is creating the organization / co-op / local currencies, et cetera, et cetera, configured in such a way that people are going to want to join in. So it's not a matter of spreading the word, it's a matter of creating the organizations. I think that's it's a misallocation. I think it's barking up the wrong tree to continually try to tell everybody about sustainability and all that. It's because that word spreads as far as it's going to spread. And the action resulting from it is the action you see. So it's not spreading the word, it's creating the organizations that needs to be done with sustainability in mind, the transition towns, all of that cluster of localization initiatives need to be brought into coherence, economic coherence.
Yeah, I can see that. It's hard to get my mind around, though.
It's all very abstract.
Yeah, unfortunately. In the introductory remarks to the Matrix piece that appeared in the Whole Earth Review, you were really positive about the activism that occurred directed towards the WTO in Seattle and in Washington, D.C. I guess that was in 1999.
Well, that was a long time ago.
Yeah, so what's the deal?
That was pre-9/11.
Yeah. So they've been able to just shut that down with the 9/11 laws? Is that what's
going on? Well, 9/11, I think something that hasn't been noticed is that 9/11 was, as much as anything, something to stop the anti-globalization movement.
Yes.
And it sure did.
Yeah.
It's like, up leading up to 9/11, in the international news, the anti-globalization movement was usually the headlines. I mean, there's always a big protest going on somewhere, and it was morphing from being anti-globalization to being anti-capitalist, and it was growing in support, and at the same time, the suppression against it was growing. The worst was in, it was in Italy, Genoa, yeah. There was an anti-globalization protest in Genoa, and with really harsh, I think somebody even was killed, in the police suppression, breaking into the dorms at night and hitting everybody with sticks.
Right, right.
So I said, wow, this is getting heavy. I said, something big is coming. I wish I had written something, but I said, something big is coming. And then came, they really want to stop this movement, and then came 9/11. So the potential that might have been there in the anti-globalization movement, that whole thing evaporated. So to look back and say that I saw hope in it, it seems antiquarian now.
Yeah.
The anti-globalization movement, it also had lots of workshops and things. It wasn't just street protests. They would always have workshops and teach-ins, and they were, evolving a consensus process that I think was probably better than the Occupy process. So there were hopeful things determinations of things, other than just protest movement.
Yeah. Well, you've always had a really strong sense of who are the gatekeepers and who are the truth speakers. And I've been kind of horrified recently to hear remarks from Chomsky criticizing 9/11 truth people. I mean, very abusively, in fact. And what's that about? What have I missed about Chomsky?
I don't know. I don't really concern myself too much with that. I mean, I've read things. I mean, he has useful analyses to offer. Obviously, very respected. And for some reason, he doesn't get it about 9/11. And some people think that's because he's a establishment gatekeeper. It could also be just his liberal psychology, you know. Maybe there's just some things he can't contemplate. I don't know. But I don't think it's very, I don't think it's a big deal what he thinks about that.
Yeah. So, and what do you think of the Occupy movement? And is there still an Occupy movement, which pretty much sums it up?
No, I don't think that was much.
Yeah.
I mean, what it was, well, like many other things, it's evidence of there being a desperate energy out there for something that works, something that really can change things. And so when something that looks at all novel and perhaps promising comes along, a lot of people will jump on it. But I don't think it was a very, it wasn't a movement that was really structured in a way that was going to go anywhere.
And you think
it was more a celebration of we are the 99%, and, you know.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think it was too egalitarian?
Oh. No, that's not the issue. It just wasn't the right movement. Didn't have the right ideas behind it. What was it aiming for?
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't building anything. It was creating a presence. It's like the anti-globalization movement, only a different kind of presence. We'll sit in parks rather than do theater, you know, in the streets.
Yeah, there have been a few spinoffs that I haven't had a chance to really follow up on, but there's that Occupy Debt movement where they're raising funds and buying out debt for people who are being strangled by debt, and they're using the same techniques that the bankers or the bill collectors use to be able to buy the debt at discount and then pay it off. And I don't know how much money they've had. I did hear they had hundreds of thousands of dollars that had been donated. They're also moving into the student loan area with some education, but the last time I looked into that, that's pretty much where it was education. In fact, more research into the problem. They weren't at having any sort of answers yet.
Well, those things are, you know, they're ameliorative, whatever the word is. They're like making things not so bad for people.
Yeah.
They're not changing things. I think that the movements that show promise of change are the things that are focused on localism, developing local institutions, you know, local economic loops, where creating situations where people can reconfigure the economics of their community in the direction of local self-sufficiency and sustainability. I think that's the path through which change can happen.
Where are you seeing that?
Well, it's something that's happening in hundreds and hundreds of places. And I really see it as tools being, prototypes being developed, you know, for things like local currencies and transition plans and co-op configurations and buy local, ways to do buy local and community-supported agriculture. It's all these components of a new society sort of being tested and prototyped. But it isn't working anywhere in the sense that you don't have any communities that have been transformed that have an all-local economy and they're sustainable and everybody's involved in the running of the community. That just hasn't happened. What you've had is just the prototype struggling to thrive and kind of limping along, you know. Like the Totneys, which is like the flagship transition town, well, they have something like a local currency, but if you really look at it, it's about the same as your supermarket giving you points when you buy things. You know, it's a marginal. You can add up, oh, we've had so many thousand pounds of transactions in the last few years in our currency, but it doesn't transform the community. So that's what I've actually been working on for the last month or so since I went to a workshop in Switzerland. And I really feel that the focus needs to be, and this kind of sounds strange, it needs to be on creating business plans of how, like, say, you know, just to make one up, it's like, okay, suppose you had a co-op, and what the co-op, like, it owned a wind turbine, you know, which gives you enough electricity to run, I don't know, thousands of houses or something. And that could be, like, the power, the energy generator for a co-op that included, like, several buildings and, say, vans to transit people around and get businesses started and old warehouses, da-da-da, and people who are unemployed are like a resource. There are people who would love to have jobs or become part of a startup company or something. You know? So, like, what you need to set up is not just a local currency or not just a transition plan. What you need to do is set up configure a sub-economy that has internal transactions in it so that a local currency can mean something and that produces something so it has, like, an external balance of payments, profits with the outside world. I mean, that kind of business plan thinking is what I think is needed in order to harness the great ideas that people have been developing for local, you know, like local currencies and stuff, to make it something that's economically viable. And when you talk about economic viability, you're talking about a business plan. That's just the language you use. And but it's the activists who are doing these things are localization activists. Their mission is sustainability. So they're not going to set up an exploitive business. They're going to set up one that embodies sustainable practices. And the one more dimension that needs to be put in there is the structure of the organizations, the way decisions are made, the processes that are used. Those need to model participatory democracy. And that's where things like group processes and consensus processes and things like that need to be part of it. Otherwise, it just becomes like a business movement, which isn't what we're after. But we're leaving out the business part. It's like all of us are so disenamored with capitalism and the profit motive and all that stuff that our minds don't go there in terms of solutions. But in fact, you know, good business is doing what needs to be done. It's not a bad thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Well, help me here because I'm probably levels of paranoid beyond anything you've experienced before. But isn't a situation like the community at Waco an example of the police state being brought down on an alternate economic model?
No.
No.
Waco was a CIA experiment in mind control.
Okay. So what was going on there?
Well, you know, it's just like with Reverend Jim Jones and lots of other ones.
Alternate economic.
You have but in both cases, you have a charismatic leader, a cult leader. And so the idea is to, you know, let them, give them free rein. You know, protecting them from the police, let them do what they're doing, and study their methods, study how it works, study how people fall into it, and then use that in terms of how you structure media propaganda and false flag events, et cetera, et cetera. That was research. It wasn't like they started a community and they said, oh, no, that we don't like socialist communities. We've got to put a stop to that.
So how does it reach the level where they have to kill everybody?
Well, it's, you know, destroy the evidence. Mm. You don't have a lot of people testifying what was really going on.
Okay. And was that a similar thing that happened with the Rajneesh community?
I don't know much about that.
Yeah, I can't.
Not something I followed.
I can't talk about it in detail, but they wound up out in one of the underpopulated states and were controlling the politics, but were still a Eastern religion commune. And then all of a sudden, Rajneesh got deported and the whole place fell apart. But and he was getting tremendous donation. You know, this is the guy who had 17 Rolls Royces, which people people thought meant that he was really crazy about material goods, but it actually meant he had so much contempt for the donations, he just put it all in fancy cars to have this idiocy going on. But anyway, I'm not a follower of Rajneesh. I think in the email the other day you brought up the Portuguese communes, not communes, but co-ops.
In Spain.
In Spain.
In the Basque country.
Oh, okay.
Is the Mondragon co-ops.
Okay.
Which are very successful. And actually Mondragon Corporation, I think it has hundreds of co-ops affiliated, or part of it, affiliated with it. And especially what they are is production. They're like factories, production co-ops.
Oh, right. Right.
They're manufacturing things.
Oh.
And they found that they limit the size of an individual co-op to, I don't know, 100, 150 people. And everybody's an equal owner. It's like everybody buys in for the same amount, you might say. And everybody has an equal say in basic company policy. But there is, you know, they do recognize the value of management, and managers can make a certain multiple more than workers, you know. And certain management does need to make decisions within the policies. However, they've also evolved lots of ways that, for instance, you know, there's workers on the board, and there's lots of council meetings, ways of meeting councils and things where everybody's voices are included, so that it has a we're all in this together team family kind of feeling. Using the way they've structured things, the way their structure has evolved over the years, works very well. And part of that is limiting the size, so that if a very successful co-op is growing and gets more orders and all that, then and they're going to need more people, then what they do is split into two different co-ops.
Okay.
Maybe, conceivably, they could both be doing the same thing, but more likely one of them would say, okay, we'll manufacture these parts and then you assemble them or whatever, you know. Anyway, they become two co-ops and split up the work somehow. So that model is very successful and over time. And a very important part of it is that it includes a bank, you know, which is also a co-op. And the role of the bank in keeping that system going is very important, because it's not just that they loan money trying to make a profit. It's that they're supportive of starting up, you know, of starting up new co-ops and making co-ops work and giving them funding when they need it, et cetera. So a supportive bank in the loop, and its profits really are going back into Mondragon, you know, because it's their co-op bank. So that's an important part of that formula.
Yeah, that's tremendous. Does that do these cooperatives provide any sort of options for health care?
Oh, I don't know. I imagine they must. You know, like any employer, it's probably part of EU law. I'm sure they would be, whatever they offer would probably be better. You know,
yeah.
The whole point is to not minimize cost to the company, but overall, best benefit the employees who are, or the owners.
And just to digress for a moment, what is your sense about why there's so much stink about Obamacare in the U.S.?
Because it's such a terrible system. I mean, it's horrible. I mean, every other sensible country in the world has a single-payer healthcare system.
But I mean,
or else Cuba has the best. It's just government-provided healthcare system. But just saying, okay, you have to have a policy, and insurance companies can charge whatever they want. Basically, it's just insane.
Yeah, I know it's insane, but the attacks I hear on it aren't structured in any sort of intelligent way. It's just sort of like the principle of mass health care is being rejected. I mean, I don't think that the right wing would be happy if Obama came out with single payer health care. But I just have a hard time knowing who's behind that, if it really is pharmaceutical companies or insurance companies or just people who want smaller government.
Well, what Obama and the Republicans say is theater.
Yeah.
It's not a debate over, it's not a debate that decides the issues. It's theater to go along with the announcement of policy.
So what does that literally mean in this case?
Well, it means that the destruction of the healthcare system was something that was planned some years ago, and this is the way they're doing it.
Okay.
And Obama didn't have any role in designing it. He probably doesn't even understand how it works. If anyone does.
Yeah. Mm. So, you also don't give much credence or any credence to the climate change science?
Well, it's just, I mean, it's a case of the emperor's new clothes.
What do you mean?
I mean, all you have to do is look at the long-term temperature data, and you can see that it's just all a joke. And they never do look at the long-term. It's like they leave it out of the equation. Hansen even says, well, we don't understand natural variation. I mean, if you don't understand natural variation, then you have no basis for saying that anything unnatural is happening.
Yeah.
And if you look at the ice core records, it turns out that you look at the pattern leading up to where we started using petroleum, and that pattern, it's almost like a sine wave, you know, sort of a declining sine wave. And in 1800, you could see that it was trending. There was going to be a 200-year rise in temperature, which is exactly what happened, and following the same pattern as it was always following. So it just so happens there was a 200-year rise, and that happens to coincide with the Industrial Revolution. But it didn't increase beyond what the natural pattern was. I mean, there was no CO2 effect. And then, you know, if you actually study the effect of CO2, it turns out it saturates. Once you get a certain amount, then putting more in doesn't add more greenhouse effect.
Okay.
And the evidence is that it was already saturated before the industrial era. I mean, you know, the only greenhouse gas that really matters is water vapor. And the, you know, if you look at clouds, you know, from space, you know, they're these swirling things. It's a temperature regulation system is what the weather system is.
Okay.
There's a whole other dimension. I mean, it turns out that you probably never heard of the electric universe model.
No.
But it turns out the universe is electric, not gravitational. And, you know, the sun is an electrical discharge. It's like an arc light. It doesn't have anything to do with nuclear. It's not nuclear It's not a nuclear furnace. It's more like a big arc light. And the temperature variations are caused by an electrical phenomenon. The sun variation, it doesn't vary. I mean, it may vary over some very long term, but we don't have any evidence for that. If you watch it over its 11-year cycle and everything, it varies like within 0.1% or something. It's constant. So temperature variation doesn't have anything to do with radiation. It has to do with the amount of electrical energy coming into the solar system.
Okay.
So, I mean, the so-called climate science, doesn't have any understanding whatsoever of climate. And the claims about CO2 are nonsense. And so they take that 200-year rise and say, oh, that was all CO2. In fact, it was none of it CO2, but they say it's all CO2. So that what that means is that each increment of CO2 has a big impact. And if you put that in your model, then you have all the polar bears dying and everything else, because CO2 is increasing. But fortunately, it doesn't have any effect on climate. And we've turned the corner. We're now on the downslope. I mean, the natural pattern is now declining.
But what about stuff like just happened in the Philippines?
Well, then you have to get into geoengineering, see?
Oh, okay.
And see, this is kind of Chomsky's problem, because once you start admitting what's really going on, then you start bringing in HAARP and chemtrails and these things that they use to control weather. So pretty soon people stop listening to you. I'm sure some of your listeners already are saying, what? Doesn't believe in global warming. Electric universe, where did that come from? See what I mean? That kind of thing can happen. So I could see Chomsky's problem. Where do you draw the line? You know, who do you want to be credible to? So my policy is just basically tell it like it is, for the most part. Although in a given article for a given audience, I'm not going to get into things I don't need to get into.
Right. But do you mind talking a little bit more about the climate change situation? I mean, for example, why is it that so many scientists would come on board with the erroneous concept?
Well, I mean, what does that mean? I mean, okay, you have some guy, what is he, he's a biophysicist or something, or he's a biologist, or he's a, I don't know. Most scientists don't know anything about climate, but they do believe in science. And so if the what they recognize as the climate science community says something is true, they say, well, I believe that, just like they believe me, what I say about biology. And us scientists need to sit together and save the planet, because, geez, according to the climate scientists, we're in dire trouble, so let's all of us scientists sign on. But not because they understand it.
Okay.
And they're in the same position as anybody else. You come out saying you don't believe in global warming, then people are going to think you're crazy. You know, your job might be in jeopardy, your scientific judgment. We don't think you have good scientific judgment in our department, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of reasons. But at the same time, there's some, I don't know how many hundreds or thousand scientists who do know something about climate and weather and meteorology have, in fact, come out against the so-called consensus.
Yeah.
And then the IPCC report itself, you know, there's the summary report which makes claims, and then if you actually look at the report itself, those claims aren't substantiated. So that it's really the IPCC report is a political document, not a scientific document.
Okay.
Now, another thing, one of the things about geoengineering, weather modification that ties into the electric universe model is that and anybody who just looks up electric universe, they have amazing videos that it's very, their arguments are very clear. A storm is really an electrical discharge from the ionosphere to the surface.
Okay.
And, you know, and the lightning is the lowest level of discharge, and then there's a thing called sprites. They have these funny names for things, that different colors of lightning that go all the way up to the ionosphere. So when you have a potential difference between the ionosphere, a strong potential difference between the ionosphere and the surface, that's when you get a storm. And that storm is carrying, charge, you know, up and down the circuit. And once you know that, then it's clear why the ability to change the ionization, the charge of the upper of the ionosphere, causes weather modification. See, once you understand what weather is, the electrical discharge, then it's clear how they can change it using HARP, which is billions of volts of energy going up to the ionosphere to give it a certain charge in a certain place. And so, like, if there's a hurricane forming and you understand the airflow involved, you could, and by changing the ionosphere to a certain place, you could steer or amplify the hurricane, and that's what they've been doing. And, partly maybe as depopulation events, and partly also so everyone says, look, see, global warming.
Yeah. And then what? That area of the Philippines that got wiped out was also their most politically radical part, I think.
Yeah, well, you know, when one is conducting a mission, one tries to get multiple multiple results.
Also you skirted around the chemtrails. Most of the people I work with, being in organic agriculture, believe chemtrails, there's no question about it. And some feel that their farms have been ruined by repeated sprayings and whatnot. But it's also hard for me to get my mind around such a large program.
Yeah, I mean, it's immense. I mean, everywhere you go in the world, I thought Switzerland might be immune. I said, well, okay, Switzerland, here's the home of the bankers. There's just as many chemtrails there as anywhere. All up and down, you know, everywhere I travel, up and down the West Coast and the States and all over Ireland and England, of course, France. So it's a global program, and it goes on every day. I mean, it's like probably there's more planes in the air than there were in World War II bombing missions. You know what I mean?
Well, that's a good point.
It's just a huge thing, and it really is amazing.
Yeah, I've started getting some therapy from renowned holistic practitioner, and in the process of checking out some of my blood work, he told me that I had toxic aluminum.
Aluminum and barium, right?
I don't think he mentioned the barium, but he said my big issue is mercury, but he said that I also had issues with aluminum, and then he said, but with the chemtrails going on, that's standard for almost everyone.
This was the doctor.
That was the doctor.
Oh, cool.
I didn't give his name, but that was...
Did he say not to?
No, he didn't say not to, but I just figured that I probably shouldn't say. I mean, it really surprised me. He just said it matter of fact. And this is a man who, it's very clear, has dedicated his life to trying to make people feel better, you know?
Yeah. If he pays attention to his blood tests, he can see the pattern.
Yeah. So,
I don't know. The theory is about that. I don't. I mean, it clearly exists, and it's clearly a huge program, and they clearly aren't wanting to admit it, which is strange. I mean, the number of people I've said, "Look, there's a chemtrail. What's that?" I said, "See, well, see that plane? Oh!" And one guy ran and got his camera. People don't look up for some reason.
Yeah, and didn't even notice the way that the trails have changed in their lifetime. But some of these farms are seeing like checkerboards laid out overhead. It gets
One time over Wexford, there were two X's. There was an X, right? A small little X over one part of town, and then another X over the other. Like what? Like Skyriders, you know?
Yeah.
It means turn it on and turn it off. It was almost like a signal. What are they playing checkerboard or across, what is it? Tic-tac-toe.
Yeah. But then, unfortunately, it's only a few degrees from that to talking about crop circles. Is that something you see any of over in Ireland?
Well, I've never seen a crop circle in person, but I've seen close-up photographs and taken by people I know personally, and that is pretty amazing. I mean, it's not something that farmers did.
With a 2x4 and a piece of rope.
It's not something you could do.
No.
If someone asks you, you know, say, okay, you can have all the resources of NASA or whatever and make a crop circle. You couldn't. Because, I mean, the plant, it's the substance of the plant itself, like, curls around into a shape that you couldn't, you know, it would break if you tried to do that. It had to be temporarily plastic while still being organic, which is, it's got to be something in the consciousness domain, not in the physics domain. It's like, it's in the domain of the power of consciousness, if you know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't make heads or tails of it, and that's all the more difficult because I've never seen one. I just have to take the word of the alternative media
you go online and perhaps you can get thousands of images you can zoom in on and see.
Yeah, I get the impression that there's a lot of them every night.
I don't know anything about quantity, but I know there have been lots and they have been observed and photographed. But I don't know anything. But some people look into the pattern where they, well, the symbols themselves, there's a lot that's been said about the symbols themselves. They're very interesting. So it's almost like a communication of some consciousness.
Yeah. Carefully skirted by the mainstream.
Oh, right. No, such things don't exist.
So you're also working with wisdom councils? Or?
Well, like I said, in one of the most important parts of any transformational movement is the processes, the culture that gets created in the movement. In other words, there have been successful revolutions throughout history, and it just is one elite taking over from another. So if we really want to transform society, that means we want to create a decentralized society, self-governing society. And we don't know how to govern ourselves. If those in charge suddenly said, hey, we got it wrong, you people do what's right, you know, there'd be riots in the streets, we wouldn't know what to do. So we have to learn how to govern ourselves. So that we can do in creating new systems in the shadow of the old on a local basis.
Okay.
But just making communities sustainable isn't enough. The process by which it becomes sustainable needs to also be the process by which we learn how to govern ourselves. And that has to do with intelligent modes of dialogue and communication and reaching agreement, including everyone's concerns in the process, not leaving anyone out and not voting. Voting just means you haven't finished the conversation.
Yeah.
So wisdom councils is a particular process that Jim Ruff came up with. But within wisdom councils is a process called dynamic facilitation, which really is the more central concept. And that particular process is one where a small group of people selected randomly from a larger population, say, can work on a problem together. And if they agree on create a solution to the problem, it's very likely to resonate with the larger community since they were selected from it, right?
Yes.
So that and other, there are, and dynamic facilitation is one process. There's many other kinds. You know, there's open space and there's future search and appreciative inquiry. There's all these different processes. And applying the right processes to community organizations as they're developing the structures of a self-governing, sustainable community using the right processes means that our ability to govern ourselves would be evolving as the things we were creating are evolving. So that component of it, the process component, is important, or, you know, essential.
Okay. What was this workshop you recently went to?
Yeah, it was on building the new in shadow of the old.
Okay.
And my friend Chris Zumbrun organized it. It's in Saint-Imier, Switzerland, which happens to be the birthplace of anarchism. There was a split off from the Third International Communist Party or something. They were becoming too authoritarian, so those who were more egalitarian split off and called themselves the anarchists, and Saint-Imier is where they met. So that was, you know, interesting. So anyway, there was about 12 people, say, came and doing all kinds of different interesting things and change-oriented activism. And several ideas came up in that. It sort of sparked my own thinking. And sort of this idea of working toward economic viability, you know, business planning, rather than just throwing things out there like local currencies and hope people buy and sell something with it, you know?
Yes.
You need, you know, sub-economy, it needs to have transactions in it. It needs to be loops. There needs to be things that people produce that other people use. And the more you have that happening, the less you need to use real money. You can just do it all with accounting, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like you could just say everybody has to work 20 hours or 10 hours a week on jobs they select as part of operating the co-op, so to speak. And in return, they get all these benefits. And there's no money, no salary, da-da-da, so no tax. It's just, you know, you're in a club, and here's what you do as a club member, and here's the benefits you get. So you can create a local economy kind of around that, those kind of concepts.
Okay. So, yeah, I don't know anything about it, but through little things that have popped up on Democracy Now!, it sounds like organization of that sort is occurring in Detroit, of all places, but it's a...
I've heard of that. There's some Mondragon activity, I think, in Detroit.
Oh, okay.
So Mondragon is trying to spread that word. I should know more about that. I don't.
Yeah, it's something to look into because a lot of people have stayed there, even though, you know, the city is bankrupt and...
Yeah,
a lot of weird things have happened to real estate and so on. But yeah,
well, there's all abandoned neighborhoods and stuff, isn't there?
Yeah, and the city has given some housing and whatnot to people who don't really get into it with cash, and so it has allowed a lot of these organizations to have a physical establishment. But I only know about it from Democracy Now!, and I do know that the people I heard interviewed and whatnot really seemed inspirational and did seem far more humanistic than the typical person you hear in a political situation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, it's like a movement becomes real when it's got non-activists in it.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's like activists are great at starting things, but there's only so many of them. And when you start getting ordinary business people and da-da-da involved and taking leadership roles and things, that's when you really got a movement.
Yeah. Well, we're drawn to the close here. Do you want to talk about your publications and what you're doing with discussion groups and websites?
Well, it's cyberjournal.org.
Okay.
If you type cyberjournal.org into your browser, then you go to my website, and it has my books and articles and email lists that you can, buttons you can press to sort of look at the archives of the email list. And then if you say, oh, that's interesting, then there's a subscribe button and there's a contact me button. And several articles there and references to books, what I call red pill books, you know. So everything's pretty accessible and people can contact me just with cyberjournal.org.
Okay. And do you have books in print?
Yeah, there's a book called Escaping the Matrix, How We the People Can Change the World.
Okay.
And I mean, my thinking has moved on since then, but I wouldn't really change the book. I mean, what's in the book is good, I think. Still, basically, the outcome's the same, even though the analysis would be different now.
Yeah, so what is the date of publication of that?
Oh, I don't know, maybe 2003 or something. I'm not sure. I think at that time, my thesis, I was seeing capitalism as the problem.
Yeah.
And I hadn't realized that capitalism is just a tool, which, and in fact, it's being abandoned as we speak. I mean, the 2008 collapse really was kind of, okay, it's time to put an end to capitalism. Let's start. Let's pull the plug.
And then what?
Well, basically, if you look at carbon trading, you can sort of see the direction of the future. It's going to be... See, capitalism is a growth-based system.
Yes.
And in a growth-based system, you're taxing productivity. As productivity is what you're nourishing, so that's what you tax. And that's where there's going to be revenue. So in a non-growth economy, it's really you're talking about the management of consumption. That's what it's all about. You're not talking about the management of production. You're talking about the management of consumption. And so it's going to be a resource economy, and basically a budget. You know, a national budget is really going to be expressed more in, oh, you get to use this many kilowatts of energy, or megawatts, or whatever, gigawatts. You know, you get this much energy, carbon allocation to live off of. That's why they have smart meters, is so they can meter down to the microsecond, you know, who's using what energy. So it'll be a resource. It's really like, in many ways, like a Soviet system, you know.
Okay.
Where you don't, you know, the industrial sector isn't about growth, it's about meeting quotas. That kind of thing. And so that's, you know, the Soviet experiment was an experiment to check out how things work under that kind of a system. It was funded by the same bankers that fund everything else.
Okay.
So my latest article is coming out in New Dawn. It's as we speak. It's a December, I guess it's December, January issue. And it's called New World Order, The End Game Has Begun. And the end game began when Cameron went to Parliament about whether to attack Syria. Because it, obviously Parliament was going to say no, and obviously Obama was going to follow suit. So right then, it showed that the neocon New American Century isn't the path that's going to be followed.
Okay.
Instead, that was kind of a created emergency that now we're going to be saved from by strengthening the UN, by giving sovereignty to the UN. So that's how they're bringing, that's how they're going to bring in their world government, is through the fact that we're going to put an end to war, diplomacy is taking over, Russia and the United States are friends, and no, we're not going to have a war on Iran. Isn't that wonderful? And it's all because we're going to have a new, strong UN.
Okay.
But nowhere in there is the discussion of chemtrails or HARP or drones. So there's a lot of the worst things, and GMOs and Monsanto, you know. None of that's on the table for reform. It's just going to be, in terms of world peace, is going to be the big thing. But once you got the UN running things, then you got global tyranny.
Yeah. Well, I think you've also mentioned that there's a goal of depopulating the south of Africa. Is that...
Well, depopulation is kind of an announced elite goal, rather massive depopulation.
That's just so they feel safer?
Well, no, just culling the herd. Who needs all these people?
Yeah.
I mean, with just a couple billion, you could run all the systems you need, and the people at the top are going to be just as comfortable as they ever were.
For sure. But what do you...
But in Africa, I mean, you can see the genocide agenda happening. You know, there's about 20 commercials a day about telling me that there's 30,000 children dying today and I could save them if I sent in $3, 3 euros. So that is happening, you know, caused by IMF policy, intentional economic destabilization, plus arming all sides and starting civil wars. So that's how they're doing it in Africa.
Yeah, well, you've also got...
Destroying the agriculture through chemtrails could be the way, and blowing up Fukushima.
Oh.
I mean, we're being attacked on all sides.
Yeah. Well, what do you make of Bill Gates' involvement with GMOs and...
Well, Bill Gates is absolutely upfront about depopulation. That's his life mission, is depopulation. He talks about how we can drastically reduce population through vaccines. And then, you know, didn't really say exactly how the vaccines are going to accomplish that, although so on with mercury, you can sort of see how.
Yeah.
And I saw a video he gave. I haven't seen much in writing, unfortunately. So you have to watch videos, but he put this formula up on. He said, first of all, he makes the statement, we can't just reduce carbon emissions. We've got to go to zero. Okay, that's what the whole point of the global warming scam is that to agree with that. We've got to reduce emissions to zero. Then he makes formula. Well, okay, well, what are emissions? It's number of people times number of units of consumption times the carbon emission per consumption. You've got to reduce that to zero. Well, the easiest term to reduce is the population term.
Yeah.
So that's Bill Gates.
Wow. I had no idea he was such a political activist.
Yeah, in a sense you could put it that in those terms, right?
And the GMO stuff is just purely for financial interest?
Well, GMOs are a depopulation device. I mean, they're putting DNA structures into our system, which we weren't evolved to digest.
Yeah.
I mean, not to mention that some of them include toxic, you know, insecticide kind of stuff built into the genes. So you're like eating poison. So there's that part. But basically, it's just non-evolved DNA. And is it digestible? Does it disturb our DNA? It's just contrary to our organism. And they talk about how, okay, well, it's one of the problems with it is it doesn't really get tested. They just say, oh, it's safe, and you know, and it's not. But it's like we don't know the consequences. My feeling is that they do know the consequences. That it's specifically engineered for depopulation purposes, not just accidentally.
So
then there's the whole other dimension of what do they call Terminator seeds, that you get into a situation where no food can be grown unless it's Monsanto chemtrail tolerant seeds.
Yeah.
Which don't germinate, you know, don't re-germinate, so you have to buy new ones each year. So you can just turn on and turn off the world food supply. That's another way to kill lots of people. So GMO, there's nothing good about GMOs.
Yeah. And yet, I think 2 weeks ago in the same week, Scientific American and The Economist had articles claiming that GMOs were the saviors for the future. And both of them depended on the idea that GMOs increased food production, which I don't think there's any example of at this point.
What that just tells you.
Yeah, it tells me.
That tells you how to understand what The Economist and Scientific American are about.
Yeah, it was the clearest example I've seen. I'd sort of been lulled into thinking that The Economist was sort of intelligent, but boy.
Well, no, The Economist is the voice of the Bank of England, really. I mean, it's and pretty much that's its origins.
Yeah.
This is what the bankers want you to think about the world.
Yeah. But compared to a lot of right-wing rhetoric that we get in this country, overall, The Economist is pretty reasonable. And in fact, it downright seems to care about people at times, you know?
Well, you got it. See, with propaganda, you've got the wrapper and you've got the meat. The wrapper and the meat. And the wrapper wants to be as attractive as possible. The meat is, you know, how you end up interpreting the world if you go along with their story.
Yeah.
I mean, if I came across a good article in The Economist or The Wall Street Journal, I repost it on my news list. So I don't have any problem with any particular source on any particular topic, but if I had to limit my input to useful sources, it would be Russia Today and Global Research.
I've never seen Russia Today. Is that is
you
that,
haven't?
No, I
I'll
haven't.
Subscribe to the YouTube channel, and you get RT. I wish they'd have subject lines that meant something. It always says RT has published a video. You know, you have to look at it to see the subject line, but it's basically it's like your daily TV news. Only it covers so much more than you're going to get in any other channel.
And it does comes from Russia?
Well, it's Russia Today. I mean, they have correspondents and the offices all over the world and stuff. You know, they're a big media operation. They were the first to get 1 billion views on YouTube or something.
Yeah, didn't know anything about it.
Oh, yeah. And, you know, you'll see things like, oh, just in, videos of train wreck. You know, I mean, you get nonsense news, too. But, they have really great programs. Well, they'll have debates about what's about Syria or about what's happening in the global financial system and, a show called Crosstalk and really top-quality stuff, good people. People that, say, used to be on American TV or something or... people that know how to run shows.
Well, I'll definitely check that out. Then, I guess I better let you go, Richard. I sure appreciate your time.
Oh, I could talk forever, and and you know, you can always edit the best hour out of if we went over. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
If you want to include some later stuff and sacrifice earlier, if you're limited to an hour.
Okay.
But anyway, nice chatting with you.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been great. So you're open for doing this again if we...
I do it anytime, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
Especially good... after there's been one, I don't know how tight your audience is or whether they always come back for the more shows, but since there's been one broadcast, then maybe the next one could be call-in. Because then people would have a context for asking questions, you know?
Yeah.
That's always fun.
Okay, yeah, I bet. Okay, well, I'll see what I can do in that regard.